This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, I'm James Kimarasamy. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Monday, the 6th of January. After Sir Keir Starmer hits back at Elon Musk's accusations about his record on grooming gangs, the government promises to implement recommendations from the Child Sexual Abuse Inquiry. We get reaction from a police whistleblower and from a Labour MP, both of whom have long campaigned on the issue. Also tonight, Justin Trudeau steps down as Canada's Prime Minister. We hear why his own Liberal Party wanted him to go. The former French President Nicolas Sarkozy goes on trial for allegedly taking millions from Colonel Gaddafi and recording the jailhouse blues in America's Deep South. After days of Elon Musk using the platform he owns, X, to berate Sir Keir Starmer for his record on tackling grooming gangs, accusing him of being complicit in the rape of Britain, the Prime Minister hit back today. Not online and not by naming Mr. Musk explicitly, but instead by calling out critics who he said had spread lies and disinformation about his actions when he was Director of Public Prosecutions. He argued that he had broken new ground and broken taboos when it came to prosecuting gangs of men of Pakistani origin who had sexually exploited vulnerable girls and young women.
For many, many years, too many victims have been completely let down by perverse ideas about community relations or by the idea that institutions must be protected above all else. And they've not been listened to and they've not been heard. And when I was chief prosecutor for 5 years, I tackled that head on because I could see what was happening. And that's why I reopened cases that had been closed and supposedly finished. I brought the first major prosecution of an Asian grooming gang. In the particular case, it was in Rochdale, but it was the first of its kind. There were many that then followed that format. I changed the whole prosecution approach.
When it came to light in recent days that his government had rejected a request by Oldham Council for a new national inquiry into historical child sexual exploitation, the Conservatives and Reform UK called for one. The Prime Minister today said that some politicians had jumped on the bandwagon of the far right, an accusation described as smear tactics from 20 years ago by the Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch. Speaking in the Commons this afternoon, the Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, said the government would implement key demands of the independent Jay inquiry into child sexual abuse, which reported more than 2 years ago.
First, I can confirm we will make it mandatory to report abuse, and we will put the measures in the Crime and Policing Bill that will be put before Parliament this spring, making it an offence with professional and criminal sanctions to fail to report or cover up child sexual abuse. Yeah. Second, we'll also legislate to make grooming an aggravating factor in the sentencing of child sexual offences, because the punishment must fit the terrible crime. And third, we will overhaul the information and evidence that is gathered on child sexual abuse and exploitation and embed it in a clear new performance framework for policing, so these crimes are taken far more seriously.
Let's speak now to our political correspondent, Hannah Miller. First of all, Hannah, what can we say about the timing of Yvette Cooper's statement today?
Well, James, I think there's no getting away from the fact that the pressure had been growing on the government to say something about this. Although, as you said earlier, it was notable that at no point did they want to name Elon Musk himself. I think we should also acknowledge in all of this that Jess Phillips, the safeguarding minister, she had already met with Alexis Jay, who chaired the inquiry before all this kicked off over the past week or so. So there had clearly been work going on behind the scenes, but she hadn't been setting out a timeline of any kind for implementing any of the recommendations. It was kind of last night into this morning that Alexis Jay called on the government to provide a clear timeline for implementing recommendations. And I think there's now this kind of sense of urgency, a sense today to be seen to say something in Parliament in light of the sort of growing pressure that there's been.
But certainly the government not giving ground, publicly at least, on these calls for a new national inquiry.
Yeah, no, they point out that the previous inquiry cost £188 million. They say it's better to focus on the actions that need to happen. Yvette Cooper said it was a deep failing that the previous government hadn't implemented the recommendations. Critics have pointed out that that's a totally different argument to the one that they're using when it comes to social care, where despite a number of reviews, they are now more than happy to have another one to work out what needs to happen. But the clear message from the government on this particular issue is that they want to be seen to be taking action rather than having another inquiry.
The Conservatives, though, they're also not giving ground. They're doubling down on their calls, aren't they?
Yeah, they say that on Wednesday, when the Children's Wellbeing Bill comes before Parliament, they're going to try to amend it to call for a national inquiry into grooming gangs. There are a few procedural hurdles there in that the amendment has to be selected by the Speaker. We don't yet know whether it will be. But if it is put to a vote at this point, we would expect it to fall because the government has such a huge majority. But once again, it becomes a kind of political game because you can see a world in which then the Conservatives and indeed Reform would be saying, well, look, all these MPs voted against a national inquiry. We can't yet say exactly how it will play out, but that seems to be the sort of direction of travel.
So what about implementation? If that's the key to this, the government has announced things. What does a timetable look like for implementing it?
So we know that in terms of the mandatory reporting, the Home Secretary talked about that coming in the Crime and Justice Bill in the spring, in terms of that being implemented. In terms of the wider recommendations, the government's committed to all 20 of them, but it was very notable today that despite all those calls for a timeline, they won't put one on it. And they say that that's because some might happen sooner than others, some are trickier than others, some are extremely complex to work through, but they are not setting themselves that timeline at all.
Hannah, many thanks. Our political correspondent, Hannah Millard there. Well, let's get some reaction to this from a couple of people who have been very closely involved in this issue. Joining us now, Maggie Oliver, who was a detective at the Greater Manchester Police. She resigned in 2012 over the force's handling of the Rochdale grooming gang cases and the treatment of the victims. And she's now head of the Maggie Oliver Foundation for Survivors of Child Sexual Abuse. Good evening, Maggie.
Good evening.
First of all, your reaction to Yvette Cooper's statement this evening?
I see the statement as a bit of a knee-jerk reaction to international horror at what has happened in our country. For me, it's more words that are more interested in dampening down the voices that are calling for this issue to be dealt with properly.
Well, yeah, well, you say words, but she is promising to implement those recommendations, actually put them into law.
Yeah, and actually that should have happened when they were first made. So I think that that is a good move. If they are quickly implemented, I would support that. But when we're talking about grooming gangs, these are men, gangs of men, groups of men that operate in abusing very vulnerable children. And whereas they're saying that there was scrutiny of organised networks, grooming gangs in the National Abuse Inquiry, I would massively push back on that. You know, the ICSA National Abuse Inquiry took 7 years £200 million. And yet the organised network...
Sorry, this is a J report, isn't it, that we're talking
the
about?
The J report, yeah. But there was only 9 days given to the grooming gangs. And in those 9 days, everything, every day, apart from half a day, was given to representatives from the police, from social services, from the organisations that have failed children. Victims' voices were not heard.
So where do you stand then on the idea of another national inquiry? Do you think there should be one specifically on grooming gangs?
I think we need to... The question is not, do we have one? It is, who would lead it? Who would be the participants in it? I'm afraid that I don't trust the authorities to want to get to the truth. So that is the key question. I wouldn't like that to be in the hands of those who have failed previously. There is a massive outcry in the country, quite rightly so, because they see tiptoeing around this issue for many years. And I have not yet seen, from what I've heard today and over the weekend, I've seen this more as back covering and trying to wriggle out of criticism rather than a real determination, you know, to get to the crux of this. And when I hear Keir Starmer saying this morning that people like me and victims and survivors are far right extremists, that again shows me that there is still a defensiveness about it, an attitude that actually people who are crying out for this to be got a proper grip of are actually the enemy. We are not. Okay. We are just crying for children who are being failed repeatedly to be heard.
Can I just ask then who you think would be the right people to lead any further inquiry? If you say anyone who's been involved in the past, presumably you're talking across the political spectrum, are you?
Yeah, I am actually. I think it should be, I think victims and survivors should be front and centre if we are going to go down that road. And somebody who is not controlled by a government whip or by the establishment, somebody who has got a real determination to get to the centre of this problem, to understand why it happens, to go into the communities from which these abusers come, to open up the conversation truthfully, honestly, to gather the data, to gather the facts and the statistics, which have never been gathered. Without that, we are tiptoeing around the edges. And up until this time, we have never had anybody really scrutinise it, not on a national basis. In the National Abuse Inquiry, all of the towns and cities, Huddersfield, Rotherham, Rochdale, Telford, Oxford, they were all excluded from that inquiry. I was excluded. Sarah Champion was meant to be a core participant. We were all silenced, and I know Sarah's there. She has done some incredible work. I think it's...
Please finish your thought, Maggie.
I think it's just people, you know, but Sarah, you know, she herself suffered because she actually dared to speak the truth. We had Lucy Allen in Telford suffered the same fate. You know, Sarah's a Labour politician and Lucy is a Conservative one. This is not a party political conversation. We need people who understand, who have lived and breathed this and who absolutely care about doing something about it. They are few and far between, I'm afraid.
Maggie, thank you so much. Maggie Oliver, their former from Greater Manchester Police, well, she referred to Sarah Champion, Labour MP for Rotherham, who's long campaigned on this issue and who is indeed on the line and joins us now. Good evening, Sarah.
Good evening to you. And it was lovely to hear Maggie. She's been an incredible campaigner on this for decades.
And was it lovely to hear what Yvette Cooper had to say today?
it was good to hear the recognition from the Home Secretary that we need to address this. I mean, I've been trying to raise these issues for 12 years now. And just when you think we're about to get somewhere, then the political attention seems to shift. And that's what's happened. I mean, Maggie was talking about the independent inquiry into child sexual abuse. 7 years of victims and survivors giving evidence, which they put a lot of trust into actually having outcomes. And then 2 years ago, when the recommendations come forward, the government doesn't implement them. The former Conservative government under Priti Patel as Home Secretary did an inquiry into grooming gangs, came forward with some recommendations, and nothing happened. So I really want to believe that this is going to be the moment when we start actually implementing recommendations rather than just talking about it.
You want to believe? It doesn't sound entirely confident in the Labour government.
I'm a realist. You know, I've been knocking around Parliament for 12 years now. And what I hope is that we actually start embedding these recommendations in. But the problem is, to be very frank with you, that to prevent child abuse and to get justice for and support for victims and survivors, the different government departments need to work together. So justice, education, and the Home Office all need to come up with solutions. They all need to come up with resources, and they all need to have that drive to make the changes. And it's hard, you know, and particularly, I get it, in a time when there's not that much money around, is this going to be the thing that the government really sort of nails its flag to and says, yes, we're going to push this through? I hope so.
Just a thought from you on what has sort of pushed this back to the front of the agenda, the tweets of or posts on X by Elon Musk, the way he has characterised how Keir Starmer acted when he was the Director of Public Prosecutions, the way he has spoken about your fellow Labour MP, Jess Phillips.
I mean, I was walking out of Parliament this evening and reflecting that everything that I've had to deal with, process, try and work on to do with child sexual exploitation is surreal. I mean, the brutality and perverseness of what those poor children experienced, the denial by people who were employed to protect them, the way that it keeps on being used as a political football rather than people putting all of their energy into preventing this crime. So the fact that Elon Musk has waded in, I should have seen it coming, because it's as surreal as all the other things that I've come across, but I definitely didn't see that one coming.
Sarah Champion, Labour MP for Rotherham, thanks very much indeed. Now, coming up later on, an award-winning record producer revisits a prison in Mississippi where he previously recorded an album of songs by the inmates.
Jesus will never, never say no.
I've returned to Parchman Prison because there had been such a strong positive response to their debut record. The administration has made great improvements there at the prison. The men were very proud of their success.
You can hear more about that very interesting record later on. But that was a different type of music. The sound there of the French Presidential Guard, as the then French President Nicolas Sarkozy hosted his Libyan counterpart Muammar Gaddafi at the Elysee Palace in 2007. Well, 17 years or 18 years later now, no fanfare at all, as the former French leader appeared in court in Paris today, facing charges that he'd taken millions of euros from Gaddafi to finance his election campaign. He has denied all the charges, as have the 12 others who are on trial with him. Now, these are far from the only criminal charges that the ex-centre-right French president has faced. In 2021, he became the first former head of state to get a custodial sentence for trying to bribe a judge, although an appeals court allowed him to wear an electronic tag instead of going to jail. So where does this case rank? Alexander Kouchner is a French journalist and political analyst.
This one is probably the most important one for him. First of all, it's very important because the allegations and the accusations are extremely, extremely grave. He faces charges of passive corruption, misappropriation of public funds, conspiracy to commit fraud, and illegal campaign financing. So we're not talking about petty crimes there, and this could really tarnish his legacy as a president. Also, these charges carry the possibility of a 10-year sentence. So this is quite heavy for him. He was the first ever president to be convicted to jail time just last month. But he was convicted to 3 years, two of which were suspended. 10 years would be a complete game changer.
And he is not the only defendant, is he?
No, there are 12 people who are his co-accused. Three of them are former ministers, and the profiles are actually extremely different. But this is going to be a very long, a very complex trial in which you will see faces of these personalities that you probably have never seen before.
How influential does Nicolas Sarkozy remain within the centre-right?
Well, he is a very important figure for the liberal conservatives. He has a very big aura with a big sway of the conservative voters, but he is no longer directly active in politics. He is not the head of his party. He is now a private citizen. He writes books and gives conferences. But it's true that he has, because of his aura, a certain clout on the French right, and he is said to be in rather close contact with President Macron, helping him to sort of navigate these very uncertain times in French politics.
What does this do to France's image, do you think?
Well, internally, it surely doesn't help French people have a lot of confidence in two elected officials. And in fact, the levels of confidence in those officials have plummeted throughout the years, and they're now at an all-time low. Now, if you're looking from the outside in, there are two ways you can look at that. Either you can look at France as a country that is not immune to corruption, even at its highest level, and that is certainly troubling. Or you can look at it and see this as a proof that France is mature enough and its judicial system is strong enough to actually prosecute and maybe convict a former president.
It's a three-month trial, isn't it? Do we have any sense yet of when we might find out whether this former president is going to get another conviction?
It's going to be a very complex and long trial. The trial itself will last 3 months, which pretty much brings us to March. And then you would probably have to wait for another couple of months to have the final sentencing. Bear in mind, this is also the first trial in this case, meaning all the accused, should they be convicted, can still file an appeal. You will not have the final word in this very complex story until, I think, a little while.
The French political analyst and journalist Alexandre Kouchner. When the Grammy Award-winning producer Ian Brennan released a recording of a group of prisoners at the Mississippi State Penitentiary singing at a Sunday morning chapel service, he was praised for bringing previously unheard voices to the outside world. Well, he's been back to the maximum security prison that's also known as Parchman Farm to record a follow-up album called Another Mississippi Sunday Morning. And he told my colleague Martin Venard why he'd returned.
Jesus will never, never say no.
I've returned to Parchman Prison because there had been such a strong positive response to their debut record. The administration has made great improvements there at the prison. The men were very proud of their success, and we were granted more time together this time, and many of them had prepared original songs. And there were also new people there that had not been there previously. We had 12 men participated for this album. They ranged in age from 23 to 74. Four of them were serving life sentences. The album was recorded in the chapel. I was alone with the men for 3 or 4 hours on a Sunday, and we just made music together the entire time. Parchman Prison has quite a history. It houses the death row for Mississippi. It's rich in history, the area, musically. You know, Muddy Waters was raised nearby. Sam Cooke and Ike Turner were born in the neighboring town. But a lot of that history is very dark, as most prisons are. And so to see something beautiful come out of an area that has had such misery is something that I think is a testimony to the human spirit.
Tell us about some of the tracks and the men who performed them.
One of the tracks that I think is a standout is a rap, which is by Jay Robinson, who's 34 years old. The song is entitled MC Hammer, and it's quite a song because it makes MC Hammer seem almost cool again.
The spirit all let me, I feel it. Holy Spirit dancing like MC Hammer.
All it is him and a beatbox provided by another prisoner, and it has groove, and it has such believability and texture and toughness, but also tenderness. One of the most striking ones was the song Let It Rain, which was sung by Mr. Hemphill. And he's 67 years old. He's been there almost his entire life. And if you listen to that voice, that shows that somebody can be redeemed, and he has.
Open the floodgates of heaven. Let it rain.
And as he was singing the song, Let It Rain, it began to rain.
And there's a poem by somebody called C. Jackson, which goes,
and they don't have to whip us anymore. Or hang us from trees. They just whip us with a prison cell and hang us for 60 years for our first cell.
Suggests that many of them feel unfairly treated.
The statistics show that by the system at large, they are unfairly treated. America now leads the world in the total number of people in prison, and African Americans are incarcerated at 5 times the rate of white Americans.
But some of them have committed very serious crimes.
Very serious crimes, and that's something to be taken very seriously and not forgotten. This is not to ever heroize the people that are involved, it's to humanize them. The lead-off song for the record is called Parchment Prison Blues. It was the last song that we recorded that day. And these 6 men huddled together and non-verbally expressed their emotion with one another and their pain and their longing. And I think it's something that transcends language. And to hear them express it so vulnerably and so openly is such a moving thing.
From Inside Prison, the Grammy Award-winning producer Ian Brennan. He was speaking to the BBC's Martin Venard. Well, elsewhere in North America, it's been a day of leaders coming and going. In Washington, D.C., it fell to Vice President Kamala Harris to officially certify, the victory of Donald Trump over her, of course, in November's U.S. presidential election. Meanwhile, in Canada, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced his widely anticipated resignation. This was how he said goodbye and au revoir to the country he has led for more than 9 years.
I intend to resign as party leader, as prime minister, after the party selects its next leader through a robust, nationwide, competitive process. This country deserves a real choice in the next election, and it has become clear to me that if I'm having to fight internal battles, I cannot be the best option in that election.
Well, the BBC's John Sudworth joins us now from a very chilly Ottawa, I think, John. And essentially, as Justin Trudeau pretty much hinted at there, he was frozen out by his own party, wasn't he?
Yes, he was, although some people would say that, his troubles began before that internal party squabbling. It's been a long 9 years. There is a sense of a Liberal Party that is tired, somewhat directionless, and looking down the barrel of opinion polls that are the worst in its history. This is a real crisis for the Liberal Party, and critics... although they've already had the knives out for Mr. Trudeau, haven't really come out in public to say that. And some people would say that has been part of the problem. It has allowed Mr. Trudeau to hang on past the point at which the party really has now just this very short time to get its house in order before federal election, which needs to take place before October.
What role would you say the Trump factor has played in this and that threat of 25% tariffs on all Canadian goods?
Yeah, it's been a big part of it. He's come in for some criticism over, what he's going to do about that. He went down to Washington, of course, recently to meet with Mr. Trump to sort of talk through what all this might mean. And if this is a crisis for the Liberal Party, Jamie, there is no doubt it is also a crisis for Canada, because it now leaves the country under the helmsmanship of a lame duck Prime Minister. He has prorogued Parliament, so there is no sitting legislature, just as Mr. Trump takes office, promising to launch this all-out trade war. Canada staring into a very uncertain political future.
And what is the time frame for finding a replacement? As you say, not much time to do it.
Not much time, no real clear front runners. Some people have said that, one of Mr. Trudeau, he referenced it himself in his speech and in his answers to journalists today, not having enacted the electoral reform that he promised when he first took office back in 2015. It is a system that leaves prime ministers with a huge amount of power, eclipsing their cabinet in many instances, and it leaves the Liberal Party with very few obvious front runners. With some people wondering who would want to take the job at this particular moment in time. They have a mountain to climb in terms of public opinion. Some of the same forces that are shaping politics elsewhere, alive and well here in Canada: populism, cost of living crisis, a rising concern about levels of immigration, the stage very definitely set for a return to power for the Canadian Conservatives, many observers feel.
John, many thanks. The BBC's John Sudworth in Ottawa. Well, Cody Blois is an MP with Mr. Trudeau's Liberal Party. And just before Christmas, he signed a letter on behalf of a number of his colleagues, which did call on the party leader to stand down in order for a replacement to be found. So how does he feel about today's announcement?
I was pleased to see that decision come down today. He has been a consequential prime minister here in the country. But I think the time is needed for leadership renewal, and his announcement today will allow for that to happen.
What was your main reason for calling for him to go?
Look, 9 years is a long time in any modern political realities. With the media environment that we're in, 24-hour news cycles, Prime Minister Trudeau has led us through difficult periods, including the first Trump administration, the renegotiation of NAFTA during the pandemic. He was in the media and in the public eye a lot. And a lot of my constituents, yes, they may have certain concerns around policy agenda, but largely I think it just became a bit of fatigue with the Prime Minister himself. And we're heading into an election year, this being 2025. By law, it has to be by October of 2025, but certainly it's looking like it could be a spring election. And the feeling is that we would be best suited under new leadership to give us the best fighting chance, to also allow for an opportunity to ask the question, what should the Liberal Party stand for in 2025 in a changed world environment?
A changed environment, a changed world environment, you say. That, of course, involves Donald Trump coming back as President of the United States. Is that your primary concern, that Justin Trudeau was not the man to deal with an incoming President of the United States who is threatening pretty significant tariffs on Canada?
No, I wouldn't say that, Jamie. I think it would be the domestic mood. The Prime Minister's approval ratings are quite low. And I'll say there's no love lost for Mr. Polyev, who would be the Conservative challenger. He has some high negatives, and a lot of the constituents I talk to, although they're wanting change, they're concerned about the type of agenda
He has high poll numbers as well, doesn't he? He is the likely winner if the election were to be held now.
Absolutely. What I'm saying is, if you look at his actual negatives, while the Conservative Party is actually polling ahead of us, I make no question about that. His actual negatives, certainly in Atlantic Canada, are quite high, but the Prime Minister's were higher. Obviously, Jamie, the question about Canada-US and Donald Trump is a deeply preoccupying question. We're 2 weeks out from an inauguration where an incoming president is proposing a 25% tariff on all Canadian imports. That's 77% of our exports that go globally, go to the United States. So this is an existential economic question. The Prime Minister actually is probably a steady hand at the wheel to handle that conversation in the short term. But our domestic political situation, I think, merited a conversation around leadership renewal, and that's what today will allow.
You talked about the need for change. You talked about 9 years being a long time for any leader. Isn't 9 years a long time for any party? What makes you think that, having seen essentially the party decide that it's no longer confident in Justin Trudeau, why should the Canadian people have confidence in your party, given it's been in power for these 9 years?
The Conservative Party in Canada has followed a little bit of the contention that's happening in the UK right now with Farage and the Reform Party, where you see Badenoch and the kind of contention within the Tory party about whether to move further to the right. That process has already happened in Canada, where the Progressive Conservative Party was actually amalgamated into a more deeply conservative party. And so there is a bit of a cleavage in the country. I think most Canadians are moderates. They may be wanting change, but I think some of the agenda that Mr. Polyev would be pushing will be uncomfortable for some Canadians. Now, we at the same time, I think the world is pivoting a little bit more back to the right. I think the Liberal Party, we've run a very progressive social agenda. We have to make sure that we are being very prudent, I think, on the fiscal question.
Are you suggesting too progressive? Do you need to go to the centre? You've gone too far to the left?
I think that we have to get back to the centre. I don't begrudge policies that we've introduced. I've been part of them for 5 years. But I think in this environment, what's happening around the world and what's also happening in our own home country, I think we need to be deeply focused on the questions of prosperity, on productivity and economic growth.
That was Cody Bloys, an MP from Justin Trudeau's Liberal Party. Now, how do you save a species? Portugal and Spain face that challenge after the Iberian lynx that's native to the two countries appeared to be heading for extinction. But a coordinated programme for breeding in captivity has increased the number of lynxes in the wild from a low of 94 back in 2003 to more than 2,000. Antonio Fernandez reports from southern Portugal.
Navarro, a male lynx, calls a female during mating season. His chances of success are now not that bad.
The Iberian lynx was very, very close to extinction. We're talking about just 25 females in reproductive age across two populations that didn't interact. We only had four animals in captivity back then. The only feline species that was threatened at this level was the saber-toothed tiger thousands of years ago.
That's Rodrigo Serra, who coordinates the program for reproduction in captivity across the peninsula. He explains the 1950s saw changes in the use of land for agriculture and brought with it efforts to protect cattle from predators. People were even paid to hunt them, he says. As more roads were built, runovers spiked. Then, from the 1980s, two pandemics led to a fall of 95% in the numbers of wild rabbits, which are key in the species' food chain. The Portuguese centre, down in the Algarve, is fairly remote, and as the animals hide away in their pens, it feels incredibly quiet. We are whispering because even though we are some 200 metres away, our presence is stressing the animals. Rodrigo says sometimes that's exactly what they need.
When we notice a litter is becoming a bit more confident or getting closer to the keeper when he's in the central corridor, we go in and chase them and make noise so that they are scared again and climb the fences. We're training them not to get close to people in the wild.
Lynxes are moved across the reproduction centres depending on the needs. And when the time comes, genetics too determine where they are released to diminish chances of inbreeding or disease. Alcoutim, on the border with Spain, is one of the places where lynxes are released. Pedro Sarmento, who has studied them for 30 years, waits by a main road, the kind that kills lynxes often.
Unlike most felines, the lynx has a short tail, has brushes in the ears and a long beard. As a biologist, there are two things that strike me when I'm handling a lynx. It's an animal with a fairly small head for its body and extraordinarily wide paws. That gives them an impulsion and ability to jump, which are rare.
These sounds of a mum calling her cubs have been captured by the camera traps set to track lynxes and their behaviour. Looking through the footage, we can see some were here just this morning. Reintroduction is not something that happens overnight. The first efforts started back in Spain in 1992. Now there's hope that by 2035, the species will reach a favourable conservation status.
Antonio Fernandez reporting from southern Portugal. Our closing headline tonight, the Home Secretary has announced that the reporting of child sexual abuse will be made compulsory for people working with children. That is The World Tonight. This is James Kamara-Sami. I'm back tomorrow at 10. But for now, from me and everyone here, good night.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.